Today on Rockin' the Suburb.
A book where people could reminisce and stuff and have good memories from the book, but also could think about, you know, deeper issues with what happened with tapes.
All right. Hello, everybody. This is Patrick Foster here, and we're on a, kind of an expanded edition of a little segment we do called Patrick's Book Nook, where we talk about music books that I have read or others have read and I discuss with them. But today we have a really cool version of this because we actually have an author on the air, which we've done occasionally, but not all that much. And I happen to be able to vouch for this guy as being super cool and a super nice person, Mark Masters, the author of High Bias, The Distorted History of the Cassette Tape, which is out very recently on the University of North Carolina Press. And also with us is Harris Kane. So welcome, gentlemen.
Hello.
Awesome. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for being here, Mark. How has everything been going in general with the book? Are you happy with sort of the reception? And it's a lovely package and all that.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it's been going great. I've been super psyched about how it's all been rolling out, I guess you could say. You know, I mean, yep. It's weird to... This is kind of a side note, but like apparently Amazon is not bound to release dates. So they started sending it out a month early.
Oh, is that right?
Which at first was I was worried it would be a problem, but in a weird way, it's made it sort of a longer release because then some people will be getting it later. And people I know have been posting it on social media when they get it. And that happens almost every couple of days. So that's been kind of a fun thing
that
to be able
cool.
to watch. And,
yeah.
I
was not aware of that.
I just like.
Yeah, I pre-ordered it from Amazon, and I got it like 2 weeks earlier. Or something.
Nice.
Yeah. Which was
that's
a surprise.
Great.
Yeah. Well, so, that's been good.
Okay, great. And, you know, we have interacted with some of the nice folks at the University of North Carolina Press previously, and that's got to be a great partner to work with on this, right?
Yeah, they've been awesome. They've been super cool. I definitely like a lot of the way they do their books, and this process was completely smooth, and everybody was great to work with there. And it was this sort of random thing where one of the people who runs a current tape label, who I actually talk about in the book, happened to be friends with an editor at UNC Press, and they had been searching for someone to write a tape book.
Oh, is that right? Wow.
Yeah. So that I lucked out really. That's Bobby Power from Geographic North Tapes. He's a great guy, and I really got lucky that worked out. So
that's fantastic. That's a really cool origin story. If you don't mind, I'm going to read the opening paragraph here of the book. And it goes the following, quote, "The cassette tape has always been dangerous. Ever since it emerged in the early 1960s, it has been used to create, to invent, to individualize. In ways unlike any other audio format, the cassette tape offered freedom to artists, musicians, and fans, the kind of freedom that scared anyone used to dictating how music is made, sold, and heard." And that, to me, really is kind of the theme that runs through this comprehensive look at the cassette tape. And do you feel that way too, Mark, that's kind of, you know, that thread right there? I guess you started the book with it, so maybe you do think so.
Yeah, it's funny. I wrote that pretty early on, and for a couple of times I thought, should I be this flat out straight stating exactly what the book's going to be about this soon? But I mean, it just felt like, yes, I should, you know, because I mean, it's clearly why I wrote the book. It's why I think the cassette's important. And really there's not another part of the book that those things don't really apply to. So that's what makes it such a rich subject too, is beyond just being a way to listen to music. It changed so many things about how people listened, how they shared, how they recorded themselves, all sorts of things that just had never happened before.
Yeah, absolutely. Harris?
Yeah, I think that's a great opening paragraph. And, you know, personally, I'm an 80s kid, like both of you. And the freedom cassette tapes offered me as just a music listener, a fan, was amazing. You know, I see both of you, you have a bunch of vinyl behind you, and I bought plenty of vinyl. I don't anymore. But when I bought a vinyl record in the 80s, I would immediately tape it onto a Maxell so I could play it in my car. I mowed grass every summer, which in South Carolina is about 7 months. So I had my Walkman, and I constantly listened to music. So it gave me that freedom that Mark said. So
the tinnitus too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's you know, so I'm coming at it not as a musician, but as a music fan. So, you know, what other stories along those lines did you, I mean, is this a nostalgia book? I'm treating it sort of that way, but it's also important, you know, for the revolutionary aspect of it. So what's the dividing line between the nostalgia and the revolutionary nature of the cassette tape?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. I definitely thought a lot about that when I was writing it. I didn't want it to just be, you know, this romantic rose-colored look back at this great thing that we'll never have, you know, that we'll never have again, a moment like this, and let's all, you know, just reminisce. Although, you know, reminiscing is obviously a big part of it, and I do like some aspects of the nostalgia for tapes, because there's one part in the book where I sort of argue that nostalgia can be, you know, more than just a cliche. It can be something that actually brings value forward from a past thing that hasn't been fully replaced yet, or nothing else can do exactly what it does. So, you know, that was a big goal of mine, to make it a book where people could reminisce and stuff and have good memories from the book, but also could think about, you know, deeper issues with what happened with tapes, why they were important, why they still have some value. All those things, I think, are applicable to more than just sort of remembering back.
And I think you did a great job of sort of balancing that, you know, nostalgia element with all the other elements about the history and about the technology, too, which I found really interesting. I mean, the stuff about, you know, the introduction of the Porta Studio and all that is great. And also, I would say, you know, it could have easily been, and I think there are, and I may have several books that are just about mixtapes. So, you know, I like the way you balance that. There's a sprinkle in there. There's a chapter, you know, of course, that you have to mention that, but it would have been easy, it seems to me, to get overwhelmed by sort of that side of it if you weren't careful.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I love mixtapes, and your personal mixtapes are a really cool part of what the cassette tape did. But I think just concentrating on that is a hard one. Like you say, there have been books that way, but it's hard to write a history of that, because it's not, there's not like famous mixtape makers in that realm, and there's not pioneers of the form, where everybody was a pioneer of the form, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. So,
you know, it's all kind of personal stories, which I think are really important, but you know, there was impact that the cassette had that was beyond just one person at a time, that I think was important too. And it's interesting, the more I've thought about it, I didn't really touch on this in the book so much, but the more I've talked about it with people and stuff, I think that the making personal mixtapes is just a different version of what other people were doing with tapes. I mean, making hip hop tapes from a party, or making a metal demo or whatever, those are all kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
There's interesting differences, but they're all kind of this freedom to do what you wanted to do with whatever you were trying to get to other people, you know?
Yeah. Well said. How long in total did you spend working on the book, Mark?
Well, I signed a contract in fall of 2018.
Okay.
So it's 5 years from beginning to end, but there was I stopped during the pandemic for about almost two years. And then from the first draft put into publishing was another year or so of revising and fact checking, things like that. So I think you could probably roughly say maybe 3 years or something like that.
Okay.
give or take. It didn't feel that long, although there are some things in it that I'm like, you know, there are interviews that are 5 years old in the book, which a lot of things can change in 5 years. But luckily that this subject lent itself to things that don't change quite as fast. So there's not too much in there that I'm like, oh, I think that person would have said it differently now.
right. Go back and give them a chance to go back on the record in a different way. What was the most challenging part of finishing this project?
Well, the actual finishing, I think, was just sort of the kind of standard fact checking and making sure I'm dotting I's and T's, crossing T's and all that stuff.
Yep.
That's always challenging, because as you know from having written anything, even the small, you know, even a paragraph for a paper or something, you read it once or twice, and then your mind locks into this kind of numbness where you can't see everything in it anymore. And so it's really hard to make sure you can pull back the perspective, not just the perspective of fact checking, but also like, it's always a challenge to figure out, what would this look like to somebody who doesn't know what I know? That's always a hard you know, because that's who's going to be reading it. So,
exactly.
So that to me is always a big challenge. And I think it worked out pretty well this time. But it's you never get it perfect. You can never completely get out of your own head with stuff like this. So.
Yeah, that's a really great point, especially with, I mean, you just flip through the index and, you know, the cross-reference stuff in the back in the bibliography. There's quite a bit of information that went into this.
A question about that, or a comment.
Sure.
as well. I mean, the chapters I think are great, and I'm not sure exactly what your background is, but I have a academic background. I'm a university instructor, ABD, not mm-hmm. quite dissertation, but close. It read mm-hmm. very academic to me as far as mm-hmm. the chapters. They could almost stand on their own. If somebody just wanted to read about the tape traders, they could read right. that. And it mm-hmm. you know, and of course, all the notes and the bibliography in the back, it seemed mm-hmm. almost like a dissertation turned into a book type mm-hmm. of situation. So I didn't know if mm-hmm. that was on purpose or you have that kind of background or what you would say about that.
I don't really. I mean, I went to grad school in English for like a half a semester and dropped out. And then okay. I went back and got a grad degree in television and film, which had nothing to do with this. So yeah, I'm not an academic per se. I mean, I've written enough stuff, you know, college papers and stuff to kind of know what's expected of that. And luckily, the press itself did not say you need to make this a certain academic format or whatever. They were pretty open to me doing however I wanted. I think the reason that it comes out a little bit as sort of like each chapter could be its own thing is that I did definitely approach it in a divide and conquer manner. I wrote each subject kind of isolatedly on its own and without cross-referencing too much of other chapters. Mostly because I think that's kind of the more interesting thing about cassettes is they kind of wormed their way into certain situations and there were some commonalities between them, but there's not like this long arc of the cassette from the first day the cassette came out to today that can be traced all that way. It kind of, as it's moving along, it dips into hip hop and then it dips into international people putting their music out that wasn't allowed otherwise, or it dips into mixtapes and things. So I kind of wanted it to have that feel of like, look, it's kind of permeating everything rather than being kind of one big narrative arc, if that makes sense.
And my comment about it being academic was not a criticism.
Oh, no, I understand. I understand. I mean, I think I was just lucky that I was able to do it with some academic approach and sort of rigor in terms of the sources and stuff without having nobody pressure me into doing one of those things where you outline what's going to happen throughout the book as the book begins, which is very common with academic books, which I understand the purpose of that, but I'm really glad I didn't have to do that because I felt like this is not the kind of book that you want to do that with.
Cost made me think it over, and it told me that you're never coming back here again. We've been doing things the same way for so long that it took me aback. But I don't think I'll ever hear that sad song again. Now, don't tell me.
One of my favorite chapters is the chapter on the tape hunters, where you found these guys that are just going all around the world to Syria and Africa and all kinds of places to collect these tapes. How did you, well, I assume other than Alan Bishop, who I think you probably knew a little bit beforehand, but how did you track down these guys like Mark Gergis and others?
Well, most of it was based on sort of what they've been able to bring back and release out here. So most of these guys are associated with some kind of labels here that do that stuff, you know, Sublime Frequencies and Awesome Tapes from Africa and stuff. And in other cases, like there's my friend Jed Bindeman is in there, who he sort of tracks down American tapes that have been.
Yeah, I found that interesting too.
Yeah. And I just happened to, you know, sort of know him and have followed his social media posts about things. And so that kind of lucked me into being able to have him in the book. And the interesting thing about that chapter is, you know, there's a whole story to be told about how tapes affected the non-Western countries. And mm-hmm. there's been a book just devoted to tapes in Northern India. There's one just devoted to tapes in Egypt. And I hope more and more of those kind of books come out. in both of those cases, those two books, the guys went and lived there to do it, which is why I could not really do anything like that for this book. So I came up on this idea that I went back and forth on, but I think ultimately works pretty well, is to tell it through the eyes of people who do go over there and do hunt things down and have rescued music that really would not exist if it weren't for the cassettes being saved.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. It really is. I just find that to be like a whole kaleidoscopic world that it opens up in your mind when you read about it. It's fascinating.
Oh, absolutely. I feel the same.
Mark, how important was it to you to make this book international, not just make it this U.S. focus? Mm-hmm. Because you talk about how, or you write about how important tapes are in many parts of the world still today for democratizing music, to spreading music.
Right. Yeah, it was very important. That section that I do talk about how it affected other places besides America and in Canada and UK or whatever is, I think that's super important. I mean, in a weird way, the impact was bigger there because not only did they have the layer of like the industries saying don't tape records, that we're going to fight blank tapes and stuff. They had another layer of the state or the government often said, you can't be putting this music out on tape. It's bad for the morale of the country, or it's immoral, or it's, you know, vulgar, whatever. So it was even more sort of a freeing, rebellious thing to be able to put these regional musics on cassette that otherwise would be censored, essentially. But it got spread around on cassettes and people selling them in kiosks on the streets and stuff faster than the government could stop it. So I think that was a very important part of the story. I wish, you know, ultimately, I've sort of had a word count limit and a length limit and everything. And if I'd had more, I might have gone into farther into like, I only barely touch on the UK. And obviously cassettes in the UK were gigantic, you know, in NME and indie circles and stuff like that. And so, and there's been a couple of really good books written about that as well. And, you know, I think ultimately you could make a book maybe double the length of this book with a lot of other scenes involved. But hopefully I touch on enough that people can at least go find out more about those things if they like it.
That was the song Velocity Girl from the artist Primal Scream right there, which was on a very important tape called C86 that was put out by the New Musical Express. And you heard Mark referencing the importance of cassettes during the British indie scene development. I think C86 actually became a term to describe a certain kind of music at one point, both encouragingly and disparagingly. We're going to hear the second part of the interview with Mark tomorrow. So I want to thank Mark very, very much for coming on into the Book Nook. And of course, Harris King for his thoughtful questions and being a big enthusiast for this book. And I do want to say as we close that, hey, it is holiday gift giving time, folks. And what better gift for your music enthusiast in your life than High Bias, the book by Mark Masters, huh? And you can go to highbiasbook.bandcamp.com and you can pick up the book there and you can get a signed copy of it. Mark will sign it for you if you buy it there. And if you do buy it, hey, just tell him you heard about it on Rockin' the Suburbs and I'm sure he would appreciate that. You never know. You can buy a bundle there that actually comes with the book and a cassette full of music. How about that? We are going to hear a song actually from that cassette by a band called White Poppy as we play out. and it's a song called Daydreaming. But I want you to be daydreaming about picking up a copy of High Bias for yourself or for a music-loving friend or family member this Christmas. And once again, I want to thank Mark very, very much. It's really a great read, and I think you'll appreciate it. You can tell from Harris and I's enthusiasm that it's right up the alley of the Rock in the Suburbs crowd. So with that, we're going to go out with White Poppy, and we will hear part two of our interview with Mark Masters about his book, High Bias, The Distorted History of the Cassette Tape. And we will talk to you then.
Walkman, and I constantly listen to music.